exists is important because it may guide how we live our life.
And we also asked if there could be another explanation for these phenomena. And Steve Novella tells us, you know, our brains create our reality. And it seems that sometimes they're more creative than at others.
Well, thanks to the down-to-earth talent that helped produce this show, Gary Niederhoff and Barbara Vance.
Also, thanks to financial support from Rena Shulsky David and Sammy David and the NASA Astrobiology Institute. Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, where scientists study the origin and nature of life. And a big thanks also to our listeners.
Your ears have been attuned to our monthly look at critical thinking, Skeptic Check. This episode, After the Hereafter. If you'd like to hear more Skeptic Check or other Big Picture Science episodes, you'll find them in our archive on our website, bigpicturescience.org.
If you're a podcast listener but prefer listening to over-the-air radio because there's always more programming coming on after, check out the listing on our website of radio stations that carry the program. And if your local station's not on that list, well, consider letting them know that you like this show. Oh, and if you have a comment, a criticism, a suggestion, maybe some faint praise, email it all to bigpicturescience@seti.org.
Skeptic Check is brought to you thanks to a generous grant from the Trimberger Family Foundation. At the Trimberger Family Foundation, we hold that skepticism is a lamp that lights the way to truth. Trimberger.org.
Henry Ford College provides a strong foundation for students pursuing a career in education, offering a two-year associate's degree in pre-education as well as pre-secondary and special education. For more information about HFC's pre-education degrees, please call 313-845-6430 or check out the pre-education program guide at hfcc.edu/programs.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is a station making waves, and for the first hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And welcome to our 9th anniversary show. I've been with WHFR Radio for 9 years now, going on a full decade. And once a year, I need to stop and just thank WHFR for giving me a platform to put out the truth about the UFO and abduction phenomenon to the world, or what portion of the world is listening. So I also want to thank our high-quality guests that have been on the show over the years. But especially I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Without you, they would have got rid of me a long time ago. So thank you for tuning in. So back to the show then. The Hudson Valley UFO flap of the late 1980s and early 1990s is one of the best document cases of ufology to include photographic evidence. And what most people don't realize is that for over 100 years, residents of New York's Hudson Valley have been experiencing startling UFO encounters and sightings. And from the mysterious airships of the early 1900s, to missing time cases since the 1920s, to the wave of massive triangles in the 1980s, and fascinating present-day cases. So Linda Zimmerman her research points to the possibility that this region may be the most active in the country. Linda is the author of over 30 books, is a popular speaker, and has made numerous appearances on television and radio. Two of her latest books are Hudson Valley UFOs and In the Night Sky, which was made into an award-winning documentary. And we're very happy to have Linda with us today to share her findings. Linda Zimmerman, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, I appreciate you, and I appreciate the books that you sent me. I have really, the Hudson Valley UFOs and In the Night Sky, they're great documented cases in there, lots of them. I did not realize that so much activity was going on in Hudson Valley.
Well, I have to admit, I grew up here, and I knew about local cases in my area growing up. And, of course, if you were anywhere in this region, you knew about the triangles in the 80s and 90s. But until I started my research, I didn't have any idea how far and wide these cases actually were.
Really? Really? So how did you first get involved with the UFOs and related phenomenon? What brought your interest to them?
Well, as I said, you know, growing up here, it was just part of your life. I thought everybody had UFO cases everywhere.
So it wasn't a matter of you were a skeptic to begin with, right?
I wasn't a skeptic. It was, you know, as a little kid, when you're hearing, you know, friends and relatives, and you're seeing it in the newspaper of UFO sightings, I kind of grew up thinking it was a normal part of life.
Right.
You know, and then when I got older, I'm like, okay, maybe we're not so normal here. But I didn't think I would be writing about it, but in my other work throughout the Hudson Valley, when I'd give a lecture, people would come up and start telling me their UFO stories. Mm-hmm. And this went on for over, you know, 10, 15 years. And I realized this was a much bigger phenomenon than I had previously realized.
Really, really. So in all your research, you've written these books. These books at least read like history lessons, but they're still exciting to read, even though I've heard so many in my research about UFOs. You can always learn something. I mean, these cases that just don't make the papers. Well, of course, most cases don't make the the papers, but they're just not even known to ufologists. But you're bringing them to the forefront. Let's begin with the airships of the early 1900s. Tell us about them.
That was a startling find. I was obviously familiar with the airships out in San Francisco in 1897 and Texas and other parts of the country. Mm. I had never heard of airships on the East Coast, and I just started going through old newspaper archives looking for, you know, anything that might be interpreted as a UFO. Mm. And in 1909, in the county where I'm living, I found a series of articles about these airships that were only seen at night. They had very bright lights. They could hover in place silently, but yet move away with blinding speed. Mm. Now, we didn't have anything like that then. You know, there was a little Wright Brothers airplane made out of sticks and fabric, you know.
We don't have anything like that now.
Good point. Absolutely. But I, you know, some modern critics say, well, it was all a result of mass hysteria.
I love that explanation.
Yeah, don't you? Yeah, but nobody, not one article was anybody thinking these were invaders from Mars.
No.
All, what they thought was either the Wright brothers or perhaps Thomas Edison, who, you know, was not too far away in New Jersey with his labs there.
Mm.
They thought some inventor had created this incredible, you know, airship that could, that had these flight characteristics. And they would say, you know, any day now we expect to see this inventor come forward, because there was huge amounts of money to be made in early aviation. So the concept that somebody would have kept this secret and never revealed it is absurd. And in the 100 years since then, no one has found any blueprints, any prototypes, any plans, absolutely no evidence that anyone was working on such an airship.
No. I mean, they would have made a fortune, right? Just coming forward.
The Wright brothers in 1909 sold one of those little stick and fabric airplanes to the Air Force for, I believe it was $32,000. And that's not current money.
No.
That is $1909. That's an instant fortune.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I couldn't convert, you know? I couldn't convert. What would that be, million or two?
Right?
Yeah. So, but at the same time, the late 1800s, early 1900s, this was the dawn of the dirigible and the Zeppelin. Is it possible that some of these or all of these could have been what people were witnessing and just didn't know what they were looking at?
Well, I certainly researched that as well. The Zeppelin was a very impressive craft, could stay in the air for like 24 hours or more, but there were no Zeppelins in the U.S. at that time. The state-of-the-art dirigible was in the military, and it was a pretty sad thing, actually. Could stay aloft for several hours, maybe go 20 miles an hour. But there were none in the Northeast at that point, and certainly were not able to go off in blinding speed. And none of them had any lights at that point.
They didn't.
No airplane had flown at night yet in 1909, and no dirigibles or airplanes had lights on them. So, and that's what people were mostly seeing. You know, some thought they could see the outline of it, but for the most part, they were seeing these very brilliant lights. And later on that same year, these airships were seen in the Worcester, Massachusetts area, and people were seeing them for hours, and they were actually beaming very, very bright spotlights down to the ground.
Hmm.
And some people were saying as if they were searching for something.
Mm-hmm.
But again, in, you know, now that we've had 100 years to look into this, there were no aircraft with huge bright spotlights on them at that point.
Well, no, I don't even know, show my ignorance about batteries. I don't even know if there were batteries back then to operate lamps, lanterns. Were there? Do you know?
There were probably, batteries, but you could imagine how big and heavy they would have been.
Right.
And with these craft, you know, needing to conserve every ounce of weight to get them off the ground and keep them in the air, it would have, it probably would not have made sense to put a huge light with a huge set of batteries. You probably wouldn't get gotten off the ground.
No. And in research in my book as well, address the possibility of these being dirigibles or Zeppelin. But some of these craft that were witnessed, the cigar-shaped craft, would turn from a horizontal to a vertical plane.
Oh.
And this is what they witnessed. And, you know, Zeppelin would not stay aloft very long if it did that.
No.
No.
No. So. Again, I just sum it up and say there was nothing at that point that could mimic all of those flight characteristics.
Right.
And as you said, even today, what is there that we have that can hover silently for hours but then take off in a heartbeat?
Right, right. It's the taking off in a heartbeat that that convinces you that it could not have been a dirigible or a Zeppelin or a blimp or...
Right.
You know, even a plane or helicopter. I've seen a video of some of these things that just... they're gone.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. Exactly.
And
That really pushed back the envelope of sightings for the Hudson Valley, that now it's not something that, as you had mentioned in your opening, that most ufologists know about the triangle flap of the 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But yet you talk to them, and they're like, what do you mean 1909? These things were happening, guys. Yeah, you know, decades and decades before.
Well, there's that case, and I'm not going to be able to say the town in Texas where a cigar-shaped object crashed and a little body was found in late 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
You know the case I'm talking about?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Do you know the city or town I'm talking about?
Yes. Are we not allowed to mention it?
Why not?
Oh, okay.
No, I just can't remember it.
Oh.
Help me.
Oh, well, now you've got me. I'm drawing a blank.
Yeah. Yeah. See, that's mass hypnosis.
That's it. We're both, it's hysteria.
Hysteria. And I was going to say, when you mentioned that, have you ever tried, you know, getting in a crowd of people and saying, look, it's a UFO up in the sky here. And everybody would look. Do you think everybody would see a UFO?
No.
I don't think so. Now,
no.
That would be mass hysteria. And that's what they're trying to sell us with this explanation of mass hysteria. Oh, one person says that, and, you know, says he sees it, and so everybody sees it. What kind of weak minds are we talking about here?
And particularly, again, no one was saying these are UFOs, these are alien spacecraft.
Right.
They were just saying, wow, there's this light in the sky. Someone must have invented something.
Mm-hmm.
And that one of the cases up in the Massachusetts area, it was around Christmas time, so there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people out and about doing shopping, and they all saw it that night, and so more people came out. So here we have a sighting in 1909 with thousands and thousands of people. And another night, the craft was seen going from Boston to New York City.
Hmm.
So that's a huge distance, which really we didn't have anything that could have done that.
No. And there's nothing, we didn't have an Air Force to, you know, send up the B-52 bombers, take them down, answer our hail or anything like that. There's really nothing we could do except look at them.
Exactly. Exactly.
Did you ever have a case back then where they one of them landed?
I have not come upon a really early case of landing in 1909.
Mm-hmm.
The earliest of something kind of landing, or at least kind of resting at tree height, was in the 1920s, and that also involved a missing time.
Okay. Tell us about that.
Speak about that. And by the way, it was Aurora, Texas.
There you go. See?
I had to look that up on my iPad because I couldn't believe I couldn't recall it.
Cheating.
I cheated.
That's
my
good.
Crib notes.
That's crib notes? Okay. Yeah, that's right. Aurora, Texas. And do you recall offhand the story of that one?
Yes, and it was actually a Bud Hopkins case.
Mm-hmm.
That he was speaking on a local radio station, and a woman called up and said, you know, I had this thing happen to me when I was a little girl, and she still was trying to understand it. She was outside playing, and there was this very bright light, and it was during the day, and this silvery craft. The tales were kind of hazy, but she wasn't... wasn't like it had landed, but maybe stopped at tree height, and she saw these beings, and she said it was like time kind of stopped, and she felt kind of stuck at the place. You know, everything got distorted, and the next thing she knows, the craft's taking off, she's going home, and her mother's yelling at her, "Where have you been all this time?" And she didn't think she was gone for very long. And after that, she started having a lot of psychological issues, like she was terrified about the thought of being brought to a doctor and being put on an examination table. And so in the 1920s, we didn't really have this whole abduction phenomena. You know, again, the critics say, well, you know, everybody is jumping on the abduction bandwagon now and just following what other people have said. Well, who was writing about alien abductions in the 1920s, you know, especially that a little girl in a small town would have heard?
Right. And it wasn't until, I believe, Betty and Barney Hill, that their case, that doctors around, the psychiatrists, psychologists around the world started comparing notes and saying, you know what, I've got people that claim the same thing. I thought they were psychotic. I thought they were delusional, schizophrenic.
Right.
But they're claiming the same thing in detail, pretty much in detail.
Yes. Yeah. When people in different parts of the country or the world in different decades are all having, you know, exact same experiences without being in contact with one another, how do you not pay attention to that as a real and very important experience?
Right. And then they'll say, well, that must be sleep paralysis.
Yeah.
Except Bud Hopkins said that, you know what, it was like only 30% of his cases that, you know, people that he worked with, 30% of them were at work or driving down the street, walking down the street. They were not in bed. They were not asleep at
the
time.
That's a very good point. Yeah. Most of the ones I have dealt with as well, they're walking home. They're driving home from work. They're going about their business. So how is that sleep paralysis? It was mass hysteria, that's what it was.
It was mass hysteria, yeah. Everybody in the world was asleep at the time. And I'm trying to think like a skeptic here.
Yeah, it's hard. I think not thinking is more along the line of what we can attribute to skeptics, because they're just not looking at the facts.
They're just not looking at the facts. I have to take a moment just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and 30 years, and we're just getting started. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're talking with Linda Zimmerman. She is a UFO researcher and paranormal researcher of the Hudson Valley UFOs, and we'll get back to her. Linda, you live out in that area. You still live out in that area, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Cool.
Lived here my whole life.
Yeah. And have you seen UFOs out there? What,
yes,
you could classify?
Yes, I did. I saw the boomerang triangle-shaped lights in the late 1980s, which was quite startling. It was massive. I can't even begin to imagine how enormous this craft was. And it was, you saw large white lights along the leading edge, which formed a V, absolutely silent, and I can still picture the way it moved. It just kind of glided, and it was silent, and the light was not a normal type of aircraft light. It had this soft quality to it, and I've mentioned that to other people in the area, and they said, yes, yes, it was this soft white, and I saw it for I don't know, maybe 15, 20 seconds moving along as I was driving. So that was very dramatic. But the one that really convinced me personally that we were not alone happened in the late 70s.
Mm.
And I was studying for a test, and a friend called and said, "Go outside, there's something strange in the sky."
Mm.
And so went running outside, and there were three whitish-yellow lights traveling together. Then they split up and went in different directions.
Hmm.
And I had a book by Frank Edwards, his
right.
UFO books.
Right, right.
So what I had read as a kid, where he had showed a picture of a UFO over a local lake. So I said to my friend and my boyfriend and his friend, I said, "Let's get in the car and drive to this lake." It was about 20 minutes away. I said, you never know. Let's just try it. So we went driving up there. I should point out, I was just in a bathrobe and slippers, not expecting, to be out that night, but right. I wasn't going to wait. I mean, this was a UFO. So we go running out there. We go driving up to this lake, and we're sitting there waiting and waiting, and I thought, all right, it was worth a try. But all of a sudden, these three lights start coming back from the three different directions they had gone. It was north, south, and east. They start coming back, and they're on a collision course. And we're all saying, oh, my God, they're going to crash. Well, they did come together, but there was no crash. There was no sound.
Mm-hmm.
There was this brilliant blue flash, and then it was one pulsing blue object that lowered down onto this mountaintop. Well, I'm ready to go running out into the woods in my slippers and bathrobe to see what this is, but at this point a state trooper pulls up and he wants to know, what is a girl in a bathrobe doing in this car with two men at this lake at that hour of the night? It was actually very amusing.
Uh-huh.
So I'm trying to explain about this UFO. And, of course, he thinks we're crazy or drunk. And I said, just turn around and look. So he turns around, and there's this pulsing blue light coming out of the woods. And his expression just changed, like he had seen a ghost. And he just said, get out of here now.
Hmm.
So we took off. He actually passed us. Taking off, driving even faster. So
that's funny.
Yeah, he didn't want anything to do with whatever that was.
Wow.
And there is nothing I can explain that these three objects could come together as one like that.
You should have stopped him for speeding.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Well, I was just happy I wasn't arrested for God knows what.
Really? But back to this blue light now, all seriousness aside.
Mm-hmm.
So you all just hightailed it out of there, right?
Yes, we did, because, when a trooper's telling you to leave, and as I said, I was in it was a very interesting position, I realized, that,
right.
Being at a lake late at night with two guys in the car and I'm in a bathrobe.
Right, right.
But also I realized running through the woods to who knows what without a flashlight or no plan was probably not the smartest thing to do.
No, but I think it's a human thing to do, human curiosity.
Right. Well, that weekend, my boyfriend and I hiked to the top of that mountain. And there, now I know people have campfires in the woods, but there was broken and charred wood at the top of this mountain, as if something large and very hot had come down. So I at least was able to verify that something was there.
Would you say that the, I assume it was round, the area? Was it round?
Yeah, it seemed to be large and round, yes.
So would you say that the circumference of the of the burned wood or damaged area was larger than the normal campfire would be?
Oh, yes. It was, there were broken and charred limbs for, I would have to say, at least a span of 60 feet. So whatever it was, now there were some rocky areas that were open, but something, you know, in the trees around that area, the limbs had been broken and charred.
Right.
So at least 60, 75 feet in diameter.
Mm. Wow. No,
that, yeah, okay. And, you know, at that point, you know, I was like, well, maybe someday we'll figure out what this was. And here we are decades later. And I'm like, nope, there's nothing I know of that could explain what we saw.
Right. So when you mentioned this boomerang shaped object that glided, this sounds kind of like the Arizona lights that Fife Symington, the former governor of Arizona, described he watched, and many witnesses described they watched, I believe it was in 97, in Arizona, just this huge boomerang-shaped object gliding across the sky.
Yes, I paid very close attention to that when it was first, you know, coming out on the news. Back then, because it was deja vu all over again. I was like, well, this is exactly what we were experiencing here the decade before.
Right.
So, and again, if it was some sort of military craft, why haven't, you know, 30 years later, why haven't we learned about it?
Yeah. Well, similar to the Arizona sightings, they weren't going to say anything. The military there wasn't going to say anything about it until it came out in the media.
Right.
And now they have to scramble for an excuse. They give one excuse. And I love the way they do that. They give one excuse, and people say, no, I'm not buying that. Okay, would you believe? Remember, Get Smart? Would you believe this? How about...
Wonderful.
Exactly. It was a Girl Scout building a campfire. That's what it was. I don't know.
Yeah, I say in this area that, you know, the magic eight balls that you'd shake it and it would come up with it. I said, you know, they must have had a cube in there that said swamp gas, Venus. You know, one of the big excuses here was ultralights or small planes flying in formation.
Right.
And in fact, there were many months, if not a year, after this these sightings began, there were a group, at least one group, if not two groups of pilots that were taking their planes, or if you know what ultralights are, those little go-karts with big weed whacker engines that make a ton of noise.
Right.
And usually on a Thursday night, they would start flying and trying to fly in a V formation. And I interviewed dozens, if not hundreds, of people who said, oh, you knew it was the planes right away from the noise. They couldn't stay in an exact formation. They're bobbing all around. And even with the ultralights, they said you could hear the pilots shouting back and forth to one another. So no one was fooled, but everyone was wondering, well, why were they doing this when it was, especially for the ultralights, it was illegal to fly at night. And what I've been hearing have not been able to confirm is someone was paying them to do this. And it could have possibly been a government agency who was paying, encouraging them to do this, to create this excuse.
Were they flying them at night just to demonstrate?
They were flying at night to try to fool people, thinking it was UFOs.
Okay.
I spoke to the daughter of one of the pilots, and she said, "Oh yeah, my dad thought it was the funniest thing that they'd go up and pretend to be a UFO, and then you'd see something in the paper the next day." And I wanted to question her more about who put them up to this and who was paying him, and then she wouldn't talk anymore. I think she realized, I probably shouldn't have said what I did.
Said too much already, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, I love the excuses they give, but you know, it's like I had a sighting, and I'm not going to tell about it now because my listeners are tired of hearing about it, but I had a sighting in 62 here in Detroit. Well, I'm in Dearborn right now, but in Detroit, and the authorities said it was the Northern Lights. Well, yeah, we saw a structured craft with huge round lights. So everybody who saw it, and hundreds of people in Detroit saw it, but those who saw it were not fooled. So they were telling you, these silly people saw Northern Lights, and given you didn't see it, who are you going to believe, you know? So
exactly. Yeah. And that was one of the main themes from the people I interviewed. They said, "Don't you tell me what I saw."
Yeah.
You know, I saw it, I can describe it, I can draw it. You know, don't tell me it was a planet that I saw or a formation of ultralights. I mean, and many of them use the word, it's an insult.
Oh, yeah.
To be treated and to be told these ridiculous lies.
Certainly, certainly. But they don't care about the handful of people, and sometimes it's not a handful of people. It's literally thousands, like in Arizona and in Hudson Valley, New York. Thousands of people. They don't care about those people whom they insult. They just want to convince the rest of the world that was, that was just the planet Venus, that was swamp gas, whatever.
Exactly. And, yeah, there were, on any given night, particularly in 82 and 83, 84 back then, there could be 5,000 witnesses on a single night. Cars would stop in the middle of on the highway. You know, I mean, these are high-speed highways. They'd pull over, they'd just stop, and people, you know, hundreds and thousands of people would get out of their cars, stand on the highway, and watch these massive craft, they said easily the size of a football field, hovering at tree level above their heads for anywhere from a minute or two to, I interviewed this one group of teachers, 20 minutes this object sat silently at tree level above their heads. And they said everybody stood there silently and just in complete awe of this. And yet then they're told it was a formation of planes. It's stupid is really what it is.
Yeah.
But like you said, if you didn't see it, you could say, oh, they were, they were making it up or they were exaggerating.
Or they were drunk.
They were drunk, yeah. Yes. I had one woman call to report a massive UFO over the high tension wires in the back of her property. It looked to be like drawing power from this, from these lines. And she called the state police, and they said, "Are you drunk?" and hung up on her.
People who say they saw a UFO, oh, that person must have been drunk. That person has never been drunk before, because you don't get, like a guy in MUFON says, you don't get drunk and see UFOs. You see UFOs, then you go get drunk. You know?
So, exactly.
You know, you might see double. the room might spin, but you don't see objects that are not there unless you got the DTs, and that takes a lot of drinking to do. So,
and, when you have 5,000 people in one night, what, they were all equally drunk night?
What a party that was, huh?
Yeah. And there was a case that will be in the next book I haven't published yet, where a woman who was, she was a trained plane spotter for LaGuardia Airport, which is a huge airport in the New York area. And her job was to identify what kind of plane it was and get the tail number. And they would verify that that tail number belonged to that plane, because a lot of, especially in the 80s, drug runners would steal a plane, change the tail number.
Mm-hmm.
So she could spot a plane at miles away, identify it, you know, as it's landing, get the tail number. So this is what she did for a living. Well, she's at a smaller airport in Westchester County, about a half an hour north of New York City, and she sees a massive object over near the airport. So she calls her friend in the tower, who's the radar operator, and he says, I have it on radar. I have never in my life seen anything like this.
Hmm.
Well, guess what happens? There's an Air Force, small Air Force base on the airport grounds. Air Force personnel, with guns drawn, kick open the door of the radar tower, threaten the man, and say, you are looking at a flock of birds. Do we understand one another? And when this woman came into work, her boss told her in no uncertain terms, we all saw a flock of birds last night, and if you say anything otherwise, we'll lose our jobs or worse.
Hmm.
So,
what year was this?
This was in the 80s as well, late 80s.
Hmm.
So, to be physically threatened with guns drawn is just mind-boggling. What gives them the right?
Yeah.
So, of course, nothing was in the paper about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, all these years passed, and I said, should you even be telling me this? What are they going to do to me now? So she didn't care.
Yeah.
But again, she identified aircraft for a living, military, civilian. She said this was not anything that we could have possibly made.
Yeah, I've seen they've interviewed people that were there at Roswell and saw the bodies, saw the debris, and Frankie Rowe, I believe her name was a witness, and she was like 12 years old at the time. And, you know, just innocent kid. Yeah, I saw. She's talking to the military officer at the time. No, you didn't see it. Well, yes, I did, you know. And they said, you know, they will find your bones out in the desert. That's a big desert out there. They will never find you. And she got so upset. Even as a woman in her 70s, she was physically shaken and started to cry when she thought of that incident. That's how badly they scared her.
I believe it. I mean, seems to be the MO of in a lot of these cases, just frighten, intimidate witnesses.
All right. I need to take one more break to remind our listeners you're listening to WHFR.FM, station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with UFO researcher and author and documentary maker and just speaker, all kinds of things there, Linda Zimmerman. Linda Zimmerman, you're going to be doing a MUFON meeting, a Michigan MUFON meeting soon, aren't you?
Yes.
Of course, when this airs, you will have already done
May 3rd?
Yeah. So when this airs, you will have already done it.
Oh, okay. Okay. But I will also be speaking at the MUFON Symposium in California in September, if anyone is going out to that.
Very good. In California. Very good. Yeah, tell us about that. Where is it in California?
I don't recall the name of the town, but it's near. It's apparently right next to the Orange County airport, I believe.
Okay.
And it's just a weekend symposium, but I was very happy to be asked to participate. That came about because I spoke at the UFO Congress meeting in Arizona in February, which was wonderful. I mean, that's a great event if no one has, you know, if you haven't been to that yet.
I've been to a couple of them.
Yeah, and I spoke on the Hudson Valley UFOs, and as a result, got a couple of other offers to speak on it, because as you had alluded to, this is new material to a lot of people, even people very interested in UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
The first year I was out there, when I had the In the Night Sky book and the film, I'd start talking to people about Hudson Valley UFOs and assuming they knew about it, and some of them would say, well, where is that? Is that in Minnesota? Is that in Florida? You know, they never even heard of the Hudson Valley.
Yeah.
Especially some of the younger people, because, you know, we're talking 30 years ago. So, you know, in a field where you're hearing about Roswell and Rendlesham Forest constantly, you know, to hear about a region of the United States that has over 100 years of UFOs is, you know, of great interest to UFO enthusiasts.
Right. Philip Imbrogno wrote Night Siege, which was about Hudson Valley UFOs.
Right.
But it concentrated on late 80s, early 90s.
Right. That was just about that era. A couple of other local books have been written about, if you've heard of the town of Pine Bush, New York,
right,
which was an incredible hot spot in the early 90s.
Mm.
But again, these books were just looking at a particular time or a particular location. And what I'm trying to do is look at the Hudson Valley as a whole over all of these generations. Mm.
So if our listeners want to hear Linda, meet Linda, as well as many other speakers, go to MUFON, that's M-U-F-O-N, .com, and click on the word symposium, and you get all the details as to the where, how, what, when, why, you know. So very good. Best of luck at that one. That's always a good one. And yeah, in doing this show in the past 9 years, actually it was a TV show locally here for another 10 years before that.
Wow.
And then, as I always say, as I got older, I find I have the face for radio, so I came here, and I've been here now for 9 years, so... But in doing the show for so long, getting so many different wonderful guests on the show, I realized more and more the Roswells, even the Hudson Valleys, and you know these cases that are spoken of so often, they're all over. I don't care. You go to any state, and their chapter of MUFON, they will have stories for you. You know. All over the country, all over the world.
Right.
All over the world. But the Hudson Valley UFOs, very, very interesting. I was going to ask you, say that these people stood and watched this craft for 20 minutes. The Air Force didn't deploy any, didn't scramble any jets to intercept or chase it away?
No, not on this occasion. I did have some eyewitnesses tell me about one of these craft over the Indian Point nuclear facility.
Mm-hmm.
They had quite a few sightings over the nuclear reactors there, and this one man stood there and watched as some military helicopters were coming after it, and as so many times happens, it just, as he described it, it went and was gone in a flash, and the helicopters didn't have a chance. And I said to him, what was the size of this craft? You know, he could compare it to the helicopter. He said, picture a living room lampshade and a fly on it. he said that was the difference between this military helicopter and the size of this craft over the nuclear facility. So there have been some instances where, you know, jets or helicopters have been deployed after it. The earliest account I've heard was that in 1953, some people were outside, beautiful, bright, sunny day, and there was a cigar, cylindrical-shaped object with these hoops of red and green lights around it, and it just sat there for 20 minutes, half an hour, and three fighter jets were scrambled from a local Air Force base, and as the jets approached, the craft started to move slightly upward, and then again, just unbelievable acceleration straight up and was gone. And the next day, the newspapers said, nothing to worry about, you know, because this was the height of the Cold War, you know, don't worry about the jets. It was all a mistake because it was a weather balloon.
There we go, weather balloon.
Weather balloon, yes. Several hundred feet with circles of lights on it that stayed in one place for half an hour and then took off like faster than any rocket we had.
A state-of-the-art weather balloon.
Yes.
Ain't technology wonderful? So why do you think that Hudson Valley region is such a magnet for UFOs anyway?
I can only speculate. They have been seen in areas where there's very high concentrations of magnetite, which, you know, is magnetized iron by old iron mines. Mm-hmm. We obviously have the river, but there's also a lot of lakes, and a lot of these craft have been seen coming in and out of the lakes or the river or by these bodies of water. So there's also a fault line not too far from here. So I don't know if it's something about the geology or the terrain that they can draw energy from, or something they can use, in other words.
Right.
Other than that, I don't know, because, you know, some people say they're here for the nuclear reactor. Well, not in 1909 or the 1920s.
Right.
You know, that's a recent thing. So I have a feeling this all predates, you know, probably even the Europeans being here. The Native Americans in the area had stories of people from the stars, people from the sky. So
Certainly. Well, of course, people say, well, that's just Native lore, but they're generally from Bible stories to Native lore, there is generally a kernel of truth in all of these quote-unquote myths.
Right, and again, the similarities.
Right.
Why would all of these cultures talk about people from the stars and, you know, depict these beings with wings?
Mm-hmm. Right, that's right. Well, of course, if they're in the sky, coming down from the sky, they would have to have wings, right?
That would be their only context,
right,
to describe them.
Right. So, and you also investigate ghosts and other paranormal activity in that area. And do you feel there's connection between ghosts/paranormal activity, UFOs?
Well, I didn't, but that's how all of these UFO stories began to come to me. I would give a lecture on local hauntings, and people would start telling me the UFO stories. And as I said, I'd say, why are you telling me this? And they're like, well, it's all connected, isn't it? And I would say, I don't see the connection, but I am finding that places that, like Pine Bush, which, you know, they call the UFO capital of the East here, probably also has one of the highest concentrations of haunted locations as well.
Hmm.
And many times, somebody contacted me just 2 days ago who says they have a lot of ghost stories and have had a lot of UFO sightings.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it's the individual who is just more attuned to these type of things or more open to the experience. I don't know what the connection could honestly be, but there seems to be some sort of correlation that's more than coincidence.
Could it possibly be that spirits and UFOs are both other dimensional beings?
That is a possibility. I'm open to any explanation at this point. That's a possibility.
But even if they go, if they're from another planet or another solar system in our galaxy, in our universe, if they travel through, say, a wormhole or a vortex to get here, they're traveling through another dimension. So somehow other dimension fits in there, you know what I'm saying?
It certainly could. I don't pretend to have answers to this. All I know is from the people I've interviewed and the research I've conducted, I like the term they use, high strangeness.
Mm-hmm.
There are certainly areas of high strangeness where they see UFOs, ghosts, throw some Bigfoot in there. There's regions of New York State with a lot of that going on.
Right.
So I don't know. There are just areas where weird things happen.
Yeah, I have said on the show before that I never was interested in Bigfoot and cryptozoology, but I hear an awful lot of stories about Bigfoot and UFOs being tied together. You never find, they've never seemed to have captured a Bigfoot. They've never found bones. I mean, you know,
right.
Like the elephant's graveyard where these guys go to die, you know?
Yeah, there should be some physical evidence at this point.
Right.
I don't doubt the reports of, you know, some of the people I've interviewed seeing, you know, tall creatures, but as you said, where's the physical evidence of them?
Right, right. Doesn't seem to be. So is it possible that UFOs come in, these Bigfoot creatures or some other kind of creatures or beings get out, do their thing, and then somebody sees them, chases them, or whatever, they get back in the UFO, they're gone.
I won't say that's not a possibility, but I've interviewed some very credible people who have seen things like that, and it's just, I don't know how to explain it. That's all I can say, but I don't doubt that it exists.
Do you find in some of your the cases that you investigate that there is missing time associated
many
with ghost stories and or Bigfoot or that type of thing? Phenomenon other than UFOs?
Other than UFOs with missing time?
Right.
Not that I can recall in any of the cases of haunting I've investigated.
Mm-hmm.
Not the same type of experience,
right,
as potential abduction.
Right. But there are a lot of missing time cases with the UFO phenomena.
I was stunned how many missing time cases there were. I did not expect to come across that many in my research, and I would say that I don't know if it's a majority of the cases, but it is an extremely high percentage where people don't just see lights or a craft. They have some very close type of encounter where it's missing time, something physical happening to them, and, you know, some sort of physical or psychological repercussions as a result.
Mm.
I actually started out as a joke, but I got serious. I started calling the Hudson Valley Abduction Alley because just so many cases like that spanning, as I said, back to the 1920s. Mm. And of course, if you know the
the Whitley Strieber books, that took place in the Hudson Valley.
Right.
His alleged abduction cases there. But it's been going on for generations. And that's the other thing, multi-generational abduction cases,
mm-hmm.
where I'm talking to somebody and, you know, getting the story, and you find out their parents had a similar thing, and now their
right.
children
right.
are having missing time and experiences. So to me, as an ex-chemist, it all looks like one big lab experiment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be. Linda Zimmerman, where can we go to learn more about your work and check out your books?
You can go to my website, gotozim.com. That's GOTOZIM.com. You can get any of my books and see my schedule there. My books are also at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, both in paperback and ebook format. And, I'd love to have people get in touch with me with their stories, particularly if they have Hudson Valley stories.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'll see them all at a conference someday.
Sounds good. Linda, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you can join us again sometime.
Thank you. I very much appreciate it.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at WHFR.FM's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage, then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is ufoimplications.com. So please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. Until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky. You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. Guys and dolls out there, this is Daddy G at the Malt Shop. So I'm inviting you to come to the Malt Shop. Just hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and head on down to the Malt Shop. We're going to play some platters from the 50s and the 60s. Here we are at the Malt Shop. Here we are back in the 50s.
My mother called me to her side. She said, son, you're growing up now.